that an asteroid impact wiped out the dinosaurs, but that such catastrophic events may have occurred many times in the history of Earth. True, there is also evidence of massive volcanic eruptions around the KT boundary, and these may have undermined the health of the biosphere. But there can be little doubt now that the fatal blow was delivered by an asteroid. The post-Chicxulub world was the world in which our mammalian ancestors would evolve. This is the world of the Cenozoic era, the past 65 million years of Earth's history. After the asteroid, a mammalian adaptive radiation. As mammals, we human beings share 90% of our genes, or about 3 billion base pairs in our DNA, with other mammals, from rats to raccoons. Somewhere among the other 10% of our DNA lie the genes that make us different. Like all mammals, we are warm-blooded, which means we need more energy than most reptiles to keep our body temperature up and our brains humming. Our brains need to be powerful because they have to generate a lot of ecological tricks to maintain these large flows of food and energy. Though the earliest mammal-like creatures were no larger than mice, they probably already nursed their young, like today's mammals, and had unusually large brains in comparison to their body size. The basic division between marsupials, mammals whose young need special protection and nourishment, often in pouches, and placentals, mammals whose young are fed within the womb through a placenta, goes back at least 170 million years. Through the long 150 million or so years of the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods, most mammal species remain small, scuttling through the moonlit undergrowth. They came in many different forms. Some were dog-like, such as Reponymimus, a creature large enough to eat small dinosaurs and their babies. Some swam, returning to the oceans. Some were bat-like. Some ate insects. Some climbed trees. About 150 million years ago, the world of mammals was changed by the evolution of new types of plants to rival the conifers and ferns that had dominated the plant world so far. These were the angiosperms, plants with fruits and flowers, the types of plants that dominate the forests and woodlands, the parks and backyards of today. Flowering plants provided a food bonanza for those mammals with teeth designed to munch on fruit and seeds, or on the many insects that also munched on flowering plants or helped pollinate them. The asteroid impact that brought down the dinosaurs may also have killed off three-quarters of all existing mammal species. But most mammals were still small, so some sneaked through the evolutionary crisis. After the planet returned to something like normalcy, survivors of the Chicxulub asteroid found themselves in a strange new world. With the dinosaurs gone, there were new opportunities. Mammals diversified in a new evolutionary radiation, as small businesses would today if every large corporation declared bankruptcy overnight. Many mammal species went big. Within 500,000 years, there were cow-sized herbivorous mammals and equally large mammalian carnivores. There were also primates, members of the order of tree-dwelling, fruit-eating mammals from which we are descended. Though the first primates already existed in the world of dinosaurs, they flourished only after the dinosaurs had left the scene. There was one more crisis to be survived before mammals could take over the Earth. That was the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, PETM for lovers of acronyms. A short, sharp shock of greenhouse warming at the border between the Paleocene and Eocene epochs, about 56 million years ago. It was damaging enough to drive many species to extinction. The PETM is of interest today because it is the most recent period of rapid greenhouse warming in Earth's history. So it may help us understand climate change today. The parallels are eerie. The amounts of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere during the PETM were similar to those being released today by the burning of fossil fuels. And 56 million years ago, the result was an increase of between 5 and 9 degrees Celsius in average global temperatures. What drove this sudden warming? Volcanic activity was unusually intense between 58 and 56 million years ago, and carbon dioxide from volcanoes would have increased levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide. But then something happened fast, over a period of perhaps just 10,000 years, about the time that has passed in human history since the appearance of agriculture. By the end of that period, many species of plants, animals, and sea dwellers had vanished. The best bet at present is that polar oceans warmed to the point where methane clathrates, frozen balls of methane which looked like ice but ignite if you put a match to them, suddenly melted, releasing large amounts of methane, a greenhouse gas even more powerful than carbon dioxide. That would have heated things up very fast. If this story is correct, we need to keep a very wary eye on methane clathrates in today's polar oceans. After a climatic spike lasting perhaps 200,000 years, global temperatures began a long, slow descent toward colder temperatures, with a few brief reversals. Carbon dioxide levels began to fall once more, while oxygen levels rose. Differences in temperature between the equator and the polar regions increased, and the ice spread across the Arctic and Antarctic, locking up water in glaciers so ocean levels fell. The cooling was caused in part by changes in the orbital cycles and tilt of Earth itself. These changes are known as Milankovitch cycles, after the scientist who first described them. As Earth's orbit and tilt altered, the amount of energy reaching Earth from the Sun shifted in subtle ways. Tectonic processes may also have been at work, as the Atlantic Ocean widened and the large southern continent of Gondwanaland cracked into separate modern continents. Antarctica settled over the South Pole, providing a platform for the build-up of huge ice sheets, while the northern continents circled the polar ocean, insulating the northern polar region from warm equatorial currents. Meanwhile, the collision of the Indian plate with Asia pushed up the Himalayas, which accelerated weathering, increasing the rate at which carbon was moved from the air to the sea and into the crust. Living organisms may also have helped chill the biosphere. In the past 30 million years, as carbon dioxide levels fell, new types of plants evolved, including the grasses that cover modern savannas and suburban lawns. They used a new form of photosynthesis, C4 photosynthesis, that was more efficient than the C3 photosynthesis used by trees and shrubs. Because it was more efficient, it sucked more carbon out of the atmosphere. Whatever the precise causes, the cooling trend that began about 50 million years ago has continued to the present day. About 2.6 million years ago, at the beginning of the Pleistocene epoch, the world entered the current phase of regular ice ages. The world had not been this cold for 250 million years, since Pangaea itself had split apart at the end of the Permian period. 50 million years ago, in this post-dinosaur, post-PETM world of chilly and erratic climate changes, our primate ancestors evolved. Part 3. Us. Chapter 7, Humans, Threshold 6. From The Language Instinct by Steven Pinker. A common language connects the members of a community into an information-sharing network with formidable collective powers. From Myth History by William H. McNeil. Humanity entire possesses a commonality which historians may hope to understand just as firmly as they can comprehend what unites any lesser group. The appearance of humans in our origin story is a big deal. We arrived just a few hundred thousand years ago, but today we are beginning to transform the biosphere. In the past, whole groups of organisms such as cyanobacteria have changed the biosphere, but never before has a single species wielded such power. And we're doing something else that's utterly new. Because we humans can share individual maps of our surroundings, we have built up a rich collective understanding of space and time that lies behind all our origin stories. This achievement, apparently unique to our species, means that today, one tiny part of the universe is beginning to understand itself. Our account of human history will barely touch on the things historians usually discuss, the wars and leaders, the states and empires, or the evolution of different artistic, religious, and philosophical traditions. Instead, we will stay with the main themes of our modern origin story. We'll watch the appearance of new forms of complexity, created this time by a new species that used information in new ways to tap into larger and larger flows of energy. We will see how humans linked first in local communities, but eventually across the world, began to transform the biosphere slowly at first, then more rapidly, until today, we have become a planet-changing species. How we humans will use our power remains unclear. But we already know that humans, and indeed the entire biosphere, stand at a moment of profound and perhaps turbulent change. How did we get here? Our modern origin story can help us get our bearings by placing human history within the much larger story of planet Earth and the universe as a whole. The view from the mountaintop can help us see what makes us different. Primate evolution in a cooling world. Culturally, we humans are astonishingly diverse, and that is part of our power. Genetically, though, we are more homogeneous than our closest living relatives, the chimps, gorillas, and orangutans. We just haven't been around long enough to diversify much. Besides, we're extraordinarily sociable, and we love to travel. So human genes have moved pretty freely from group to group. We belong to the mammalian order primates, which includes lemurs, monkeys, and great apes. And we share a lot with our primate relatives. The earliest primates almost certainly lived in trees, and young humans, I include my young self here, love climbing trees and are good at it. To climb trees, you need hands and fingers, or feet and toes that can grip. If you're going to leap from branch to branch, it's a good idea to have stereoscopic vision so you can judge distances. That means having two eyes at the front of your face, with overlapping lines of sight. Don't try jumping from branch to branch with one eye closed. So all primates have hands and feet that can grip, and flattish faces with eyes at the front. Primates are exceptionally brainy. Their brains are unusually large relative to their bodies, and the top front layer of the brain, the neocortex, is gigantic. In most mammal species, the cortex accounts for between 10% and 40% of brain size. In primates, it accounts for more than 50%, and in humans, for as much as 80%. Humans are exceptional for the sheer number of their cortical neurons. They have about 15 billion, or more than twice as many as chimpanzees, with about 6 billion. Whales and elephants, the next in line after humans on the most cortical neurons list, have about 10 billion cortical neurons, but they have smaller brains than chimps relative to body size. Large brains mean that primates are wizards at acquiring, storing, and using information about their surroundings. Why are primate brains so big? This may seem, pardon the pun, a no-brainer. Aren't brains obviously a good thing? Not necessarily, because they guzzle energy. They need up to 20 times as much energy as the equivalent amount of muscle tissue. In human bodies, the brain uses 16% of available energy, though it accounts for just 2% of the body's mass. That's why, given the choice between brawn and brain, evolution has generally gone for more brawn and less brain. And that's why there are so few very brainy species. Some species are so disdainful of brains that they treat them as an expendable luxury. There are species of sea slugs that have mini-brains when they are young. They use them as they voyage through the seas looking for a perch from which they can sieve food. But once they've found their perch, they no longer need such an expensive piece of equipment, so they eat their brains. Some have joked, cruelly, that this is a bit like tenured academics. However, primate brains do seem to pay their way. They are needed to manage those dexterous hands and feet. And in a very visual species, they are needed to process images. Is that a ripe plum three trees away? Because images gobble up processing power in brains just as they do in computers. Even more important, primates are sociable, because living in groups provides protection and support. The pressure to live in large groups increased in open and exposed terrain, such as the spreading grasslands and woodlands of a cooling post-PETM world. To live successfully with other members of your species, you have to keep track of the constantly changing relationships among family, friends, and enemies. Who's up and who's down? Who's friendly and who's not? Who owes me favors? And who am I in debt to? These are computational tasks whose complexity increases exponentially as groups get larger. If there are just three others, you can probably cope. If there are 50 or 100, the calculations are a lot trickier. To live in groups, you also need some insight into the brains of others. Intuiting the thoughts and feelings of others may have been an important step toward consciousness, the enhanced awareness of what is happening in our own minds. Close observation of primate societies shows that if you get these social calculations wrong, you'll probably eat less well, be less well protected, get beaten up more often, and lower your chances of being healthy and having healthy children. So sociability, cooperation, and brain power seem to have evolved together in the history of primates. Indeed, there seems to be a rough correlation between the size of primate groups and the size of their brains. Apparently, many primate lineages were willing to pay one more entropy tax, the brain tax, if it allowed them to live in larger groups. The first primates probably evolved before the dinosaurs were wiped out, but the earliest surviving primate fossils date from several million years after the Chicxulub landing. We belong to the group of large tailless primates known as apes. Apes evolved about 30 million years ago and flourished and diversified in Africa and Eurasia 20 million years ago. The great apes, or hominids, include today the orangutans, gorillas, and chimpanzees, as well as humans. Their ancestors evolved in a post-PETM world of falling carbon dioxide levels and chillier and less predictable climates. Climatic instability pressed hard on the evolutionary accelerator, forcing many different species to adapt fast and often. From about 10 million years ago, climates became drier and chillier over much of the range of great apes, and the ape lineage was culled, perhaps quite severely, as their forest homes were replaced by grasslands. Our ancestors were survivors of this evolutionary forced march. Before the 1970s, most paleontologists were convinced from the fossil evidence that humans had diverged from other apes at least 20 million years ago. But in 1968, two geneticists, Vincent Sarich and Alan Wilson, showed that we could estimate when two species diverged by comparing the DNA of species that are alive today. This is because large stretches of DNA, particularly those parts that do not code for genes, change randomly and at a relatively consistent pace. Genetic comparisons using these insights show that humans, chimps, and gorillas shared a common ancestor until about 8 million years ago, at which point the ancestors of modern gorillas decided to go their merry way. Humans and chimps shared a common ancestor up to about 6 or 7 million years ago. In other words, somewhere in Africa 6 or 7 million years ago, there existed a creature from which modern humans and chimpanzees are both descended. We do not yet have fossil remains of this creature, but modern genetics tell us it was really there. Modern chimps and humans still share well over 96% of their genomes. But with 3 billion base pairs in each genome, that means that about 35 million genetic letters or base pairs are different. Lurking among these divergent genetic letters are the clues that can tell us why humans and the chimps have had such radically different histories, particularly in recent millennia. Why are our closest relatives now reduced to remnant populations of a few hundred thousand, while there are now more than 7 billion humans, and we dominate the biosphere? Early hominin history. When did the first humans appear? All species on the human side of the evolutionary divide between humans and chimps are known as hominins. In the past 50 years, paleontologists have found fossil remains, sometimes just a finger bone or a few teeth, from perhaps 30 or more species of hominins. I say perhaps because deciding what is a distinct species depends on which paleontologist you talk to. Some are splitters. They see many different species of hominins. Others are lumpers. They see fewer species, but a lot of variation within each species. Today, we are the only surviving hominin species. That is unusual, because until as recently as 20 or 30,000 years ago, several different species of hominins cruised the savannas of Africa and Eurasia at the same time. The recent disappearance of other hominin species as we humans took up more and more land and resources is a sign of how dangerous we are. In the past 50 years, paleontologists have acquired a lot of new forensic toys and tricks that have helped them fill in more details of hominin history. Fossilized teeth are particularly informative. That's good because teeth are often the only remains we find. Just as your dentist can tell if you've been eating popcorn, chocolate, and ice cream, so too a good paleontological dentist can tell whether our ancestors were eating meat or plants. The shape of a tooth can tell us whether it was used to cut or grind its owner's food, and that is very informative. Nuts require grinding teeth, such as molars, while meat requires cutting teeth, such as canines. Chemical signals found in bones and teeth can also tell us a lot about diets and life ways. For example, C4 photosynthesizers, such as grasses and sedges, absorb more of the slightly heavier carbon isotope carbon-13 than they do of the more common carbon-12. Analysis of the teeth of Australopithecus africanus from about 2.5 million years ago shows higher than expected carbon-13 ratios, and as they surely were not eating grasses, no apes can eat grasses. This suggests that they were eating the meat of animals that were eating grasses. And meat eating implies they were either scavenging or hunting, and perhaps using stone tools. Chemical analysis of strontium isotopes in bones can even tell us how widely individuals roamed. Studies of the bones of a group of early hominins known as Australopithecines have shown that females travelled more than males, which suggests that females joined groups of males rather than the other way around. In other words, their communities were patrilocal, like those of modern chimps. And that tells us a lot about their social world. These are powerful sleuthing tools. But unfortunately, they often yield more questions than answers, reminding us how complex the story of human evolution really is. The fossil record of hominins is much richer than it used to be. In 1900, anthropologists had fossil remains from only two ancient types of humans. Neanderthals, the first of which was found in Germany in 1848, and Homo erectus, whose remains were first found in 1891 in Java, by Dutch paleoanthropologist Eugène Dubois. These finds suggested that humans could have evolved in Europe or Asia. But in 1924, Raymond Dart, an Australian professor of anatomy based in South Africa, discovered the first important African hominin fossil. It was a skull sitting among a collection of other fossils, the skull of a child from the species now known as Australopithecus africanus, part of a large group of Australopithecine species that first appeared about 5 million years ago. After this discovery, more and more hominin fossils began to turn up in Africa, and most paleoanthropologists now believe that our species evolved somewhere in Africa. From the 1930s, Lewis and Mary Leakey began finding hominin fossils and artifacts in Africa's Rift Valley, where magma pushing up from the mantle has started splitting the tectonic plate on which most of Africa lies. Eventually, a new sea will appear here. Meanwhile, cracks in the African tectonic plate give fossil hunters glimpses into the remote past of our species. In 1974 in Ethiopia, Donald Johansson discovered 40% of the skeleton of another Australopithecine species, Australopithecus afarensis. The skeleton was named Lucy and dated to about 3.2 million years ago. Other Australopithecine remains have been found that are almost 4 million years old. Since then, earlier hominin species have been found in other parts of Africa, dating to 4 and 5 million years ago, Ardipithecus, and even to 6 million years ago, Orrorin tugenensis, or perhaps 7, Sahelanthropus chadensis, which is pretty close to the notional date when the last common ancestor of all hominins lived. We have so few very early hominin fossils that a single new discovery could change the story radically. It is not even certain that the oldest fossils are really hominins, nor is it always clear whether fossil remains belong to distinct species or not. Should Homo habilis and Homo erectus, species with very different brain sizes, be assigned to different genera? Or should H. habilis be regarded as late Australopithecines? Our understanding of early hominin history remains sketchy, but parts of the story are getting clearer. Even the earliest hominin species seem to have walked on two legs, at least some of the time. This is very different from chimps and gorillas, which knuckle walk. You can tell from bones if a species regularly walks on two legs. In bipedal species, the big toe is no longer used for gripping, so it aligns more closely with the other toes, while the spine enters the skull from below, not from the back. Get down on four legs and you'll understand why. Walking on two legs required rearrangements of the back, the hips, even the brain case. It also favored narrower hips, which made childbearing more difficult and dangerous, and probably means that many hominins, like modern humans, gave birth to infants that were not yet capable of surviving on their own. That would have meant that their babies needed more parenting, which may have encouraged sociability and gotten hominin fathers more involved in child-rearing. There were many indirect effects of bipedalism, but we're not yet sure exactly why hominins became bipedal. Perhaps bipedalism let our ancestors walk or run farther in the grassy savanna lands that had spread around a cooling world in the past 30 million years. It also freed human hands to specialize in manipulative tasks, including, eventually, the making of tools. There are no signs that the earliest hominins were exceptionally brainy by primate standards. Their skulls contained brains much smaller than ours, and more like chimpanzee brains, with a volume of about 300 to 450 cubic centimeters. Our brains, in comparison, average about 1,350 cubic centimeters. More significant than absolute size, though not easy to calculate, is the extent to which brain size deviates from the expected brain size for a given body weight within a particular group of organisms. This is the encephalization quotient, EQ. Chimps have an EQ of about 2 compared to other mammals, and modern humans have an extraordinarily high EQ of about 5.8. The EQs of Australopithecines range from 2.4 to 3.1. Extreme braininess was not the first distinguishing feature of the hominins. Bipedalism was. The first fossils that are currently classified within our own genus, Homo, belong to a species known as Homo habilis, which lived in Africa from about 2.5 to 1.5 million years ago. The first evidence of this species, consisting just of a jawbone and some hand bones, was found in 1960 by Mary Leakey and her son, Jonathan, in Olduvai Gorge in the African Rift Valley. The close association with stone tools persuaded the Leakeys to classify their new species as a form of Homo, which was a paleontologist's way of saying, I think these are really humans because they made tools. But were they us? Is this when human history began? Today, most researchers are skeptical about a distinct Homo genus that includes both us and habilis. After all, habilis brains were only slightly larger than those of Australopithecines, ranging from 500 to 700 cubic centimeters, with an encephalization quotient of just over 3. And their stone tools involved little more than smashing rocks and using the fragments. Given that some Australopithecine species probably made stone tools, and that chimps, too, can make tools, though not stone tools, it looks as if Homo habilis was similar enough to the Australopithecines to be classified with them. Tool use does not make them human, because we now know that tool making is not unique to humans. Later hominin history. The past 2 million years. By 2 million years ago, at the beginning of the Pleistocene epoch, we find hominin species that were larger, had bigger brains, made more sophisticated stone tools, and exploited a wider range of environments. It is probably no coincidence that they appeared as climates were getting colder and drier. These species are normally classified as Homo erectus or Homo ergaster, but here I will use the label H. erectus for the whole group. The large brains of H. erectus are striking because, as we have seen, brains are costly evolutionary machines. Indeed, the rate of increase of brain size to body weight in hominins was faster than the rates in any other group of species in evolutionary history. Perhaps sociability was the driver. The importance of social calculations shows up clearly in the human brain structure, which devotes an exceptional number of neuronal pathways to social calculations. Perhaps more neurons meant more friends, more food, better health, and a better chance of reproducing. Certainly, larger brains allowed hominins to live in larger groups and networks. Most primates, including chimps and baboons, lived in groups of fewer than 50 individuals, and roughly, the smaller the brain, the smaller the group. But as brain sizes increased in the past 2 million years, the size of hominin groups increased too. Homo erectus was probably the first hominin species to live in groups that linked more than 50 individuals. The first H. erectus remains were found in Java in 1891 by Eugène Dubois. He was looking in Indonesia because of a hunch he had that humans were descended not from African chimpanzees, Darwin's bet, but from Asian orangutans. He got that wrong. But the remains he found did have brains with volumes of almost 900 cubic centimeters, much closer to the modern human average of about 1,350 cubic centimeters. And they had an EQ of 3 to 4. The fact that the remains were found in Java also showed that H. erectus had the technologies and skills needed to migrate from Africa through much of southern Eurasia. But we shouldn't be too impressed by this. Many other species, such as lions, tigers, elephants, and even our close relatives, the orangutans, had made similar migrations. And that's because many environments in southern Eurasia are not that different from African environments. Indeed, recent evidence suggests that species closely related to Homo habilis may have traveled as far as Indonesia to become the ancestors of the tiny hominins known as Homo floresiensis, or the hobbits, which lived on the island of Flores as recently as 60,000 years ago. H. erectus were taller than H. habilis, some of them as tall as modern humans. They also made more sophisticated stone tools than H. habilis. These are the beautiful and carefully designed stone tools known as Acheulean axes. Better stone tools may have given H. erectus access to more meat, a crucial source of high-energy food to fuel their expanding brains. They may have also learned to manage, control, and use fire, which would have allowed them to tap into a huge new source of energy. The primatologist Richard Wrangham has argued that H. erectus use fire to cook. In other words, to pre-digest and detoxify meat and other foods. This would have increased the range of foods they could eat, because many foods are indigestible or poisonous until cooked. Cooking would also have reduced the time they spent chewing and digesting their food. Use of fire may have had other important consequences. For example, cooking reduced the digestive work required of the gut, so the gut shrank. And yes, there is fossil evidence for this, releasing some of the metabolic energy needed to run larger brains. And yet, this interesting hypothesis remains unproven, because good evidence for systematic control of fire appears only from about 800,000 years ago, and becomes quite common only after about 400,000 years ago. We also know that the stone technologies of H. erectus changed little over a million years. So H. erectus seemed to have lacked the technological flair and creativity of our own species. In the past million years, hominin evolution accelerated. About 600,000 years ago, new species appear in the fossil record, with brains and bodies more and more like modern humans. Not surprisingly, they apparently lived in larger groups too, groups that linked as many as 150 individuals, which seems to have been the upper limit among our hominin ancestors. There are complex debates about how many different species of hominins there were half a million years ago. We know there were many. But more important is the larger trend. Now hominins appear in Ice Age Europe and Northern Asia, environments that were very different from the African savanna and demanded new skills and technologies. So it is no surprise that their tools were more sophisticated, more varied, and more specialized than those of H. erectus. For the first time, hominins hafted stone points to wooden shafts. In Schönigen, Germany, archaeologists have found 400,000-year-old wooden spears made with precision and delicacy. Some anthropologists have even detected evidence of artistic and ritual activity. Among the finds of Eugène Dubois were decorated mussel shells dated to 500,000 years ago that look suspiciously like simple forms of art. Still, none of this was revolutionary. The really spectacular changes began only about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago, after the appearance of our own species, Homo sapiens. What makes us different? Crossing Threshold 6. Imagine a team of alien scientists who have been orbiting our planet, searching for intelligent life and studying Earth's life forms in a longitudinal research project lasting several million years. 200,000 years ago, they wouldn't have noticed anything unusual about our ancestors. In Africa and parts of Europe and Asia, they might have spotted several species of large bipedal primates, including a species we call Homo neanderthalensis and Homo heidelbergensis. They might even have seen individuals that a modern human paleontologist would describe as Homo sapiens, because the oldest skull normally assigned to our species is almost 200,000 years old. It was found at Omo Valley in Ethiopia, in the African Rift Valley. In June 2017, human remains from Morocco were dated to 300,000 years ago. But their exact relationship to us remains uncertain. But there was little to distinguish these early humans from many other large or medium-sized primate and mammal species. They lived in small, scattered nomadic communities, with a total population of, at most, a few hundred thousand individuals. Like all large animals, they gathered or hunted the food and energy they needed from their surroundings. Today, 200,000 or 300,000 years later, no time at all for a paleontologist, our orbiting aliens searching for intelligent life would have seen through changes in the behavior of this particular species to justify a few scholarly high fives. They would have watched as humans spread around the world. Then, starting from the end of the last ice age, 10,000 years ago, they would have noticed human numbers growing fast. They would also have watched as humans began to change their environments to suit them better by burning down forests, diverting rivers, plowing the land, and building towns and cities. In the past 200 years, human numbers grew to over 7 billion, and our species began to transform the oceans, the land, and the air. Human-built roads, canals and railways snaked across the continents, linking thousands of human-built cities with populations in the millions. Vast ships navigated the oceans, and planes ferried goods and people through the air and across the continents. Just 100 years ago, in glowing filaments and patches, Earth started lighting up at night. The aliens' instruments would have also shown that oceans were getting more acidic. The atmosphere was warming. Coral reefs were dying, and polar ice caps were shrinking. Biodiversity was declining so fast that some of the alien biologists might have wondered if this were the start of another mass extinction. Paleontologically speaking, changes this fast are the equivalent of an explosion. Without planning it, we have become a planet-changing species. We even have the power, if we are foolish enough, to destroy much of the biosphere in just a few hours by launching some of the 1,800 nuclear missiles that remain on high alert today. No single species has had such power in the 4-billion-year history of the biosphere. Clearly, a new threshold had been crossed. Our alien scientists would surely have been asking themselves, what is it about this strange species? Historians, anthropologists, philosophers and scholars in many other fields have wrestled long and hard with the same question. Some feel the question is too complex, too loaded, and too multidimensional to yield a scientific answer. But curiously, when we see human history as part of a larger history of the biosphere and the universe, the distinctive features of our species stand out more clearly. Today, scholars in many different fields seem to be converging on similar answers to the question of what makes us different. When you see sudden, rapid changes like this, start looking for tiny changes that have huge consequences. Complexity theory and the related field of chaos theory are full of changes like this. Often, they are described as butterfly effects. The metaphor comes from the meteorologist Edward Lorenz, who pointed out that in weather systems, tiny events, the flapping of a butterfly's wings, perhaps, can get amplified by positive feedback cycles, generating a cascade of changes that may unleash tornadoes thousands of miles away. So what tiny changes unleash the tornado of human history? Many different features make up the human package, from dexterous hands to large brains and sociability. But what makes us radically different is our collective control of information about our surroundings. We don't just gather information like other species. We seem to cultivate and domesticate it, as farmers cultivate crops. We generate and share more and more information, and use it to tap larger and larger flows of energy and resources. New information gave humans improved spears and bows and arrows that allowed them to hunt larger animals more safely. It gave them better boats that gave them access to new fisheries and new lands, and it offered new botanical knowledge that allowed them to leach the poisons from potentially edible plants such as cassava. In more modern times, new information lay behind the technologies that let us tap the energy of fossil fuels and build the electronic networks that link us into a single world system. Information management on this scale was not the achievement of individuals. It depended on sharing, on the accumulation of millions of individual insights over many generations. Eventually, community by community, this sharing created what the Russian geologist Vladimir Vernadsky called a noosphere, a single global realm of mind, of culture, of shared thoughts and ideas. There is, writes Michael Tomasello, only one known biological mechanism that could bring about these kinds of changes in behavior and cognition in so short a time. This biological mechanism is social or cultural transmission, which works on timescales many orders of magnitude faster than those of organic evolution. This process, which Tomasello calls cumulative cultural evolution, is unique to our species. The tiny change that allowed humans to share and accumulate so much information was linguistic. Many species have languages. Birds and baboons can warn others in their group of the approach of predators. But animal languages can share only the simplest of ideas, almost all of them linked to what is immediately present, a bit like mime. Imagine trying to teach biochemistry or winemaking in mime. Several researchers have tried to teach chimps to talk, and chimps can indeed acquire and use vocabularies of 100 or 200 words. They can even link pairs of words in new patterns. But their vocabularies are small, and they don't use syntax or grammar, the rules that allow us to generate a huge variety of meanings from a small number of verbal tokens. Their linguistic ability seems never to exceed that of a 2 or 3-year-old human, and that is not enough to create today's world. And here's where the butterfly flapped its wings. Human language crossed a subtle linguistic threshold that allowed utterly new types of communication. Above all, human languages let us share information about abstract entities or about things or possibilities that are not immediately present and may not even exist outside of our imagination. And they let us do this fast and efficiently. With the partial exception of honeybees, whose dancers can tell other bees where to find honey, we know of no animals that can transmit precise information about what is not right in front of them. No animal can swap stories about the future or the past, or warn about the lion pride 10 miles to the north, or tell you about gods or demons. They may be able to think about such things, but they cannot talk about them. And that may be why it is hard to find any evidence for teaching within any other species, even among our closest relatives, the monkeys and apes. These linguistic enhancements allowed humans to share information with such precision and clarity that knowledge began to accumulate from generation to generation. Animal languages are too limited and too imprecise to allow this sort of accumulation. If any earlier species did have this ability, it would surely have left traces, including an expanding range and an increasing impact on its environment. In fact, we would see the sort of evidence we find for human history. Human language is powerful enough to act like a cultural ratchet, locking in the ideas of one generation and preserving them for the next generation, which can add to them in its turn. I call this mechanism collective learning. Collective learning is a new driver of change, and it can drive change as powerfully as natural selection. But because it allows instantaneous exchanges of information, it works much faster. How and why our species acquire the linguistic power needed to unleash this powerful new driver of change remains unclear. Was it, as American neuroanthropologist Terence Deacon has argued, a new ability to compress large amounts of information into symbols, deceptively simple words like symbol, that carry a huge informational cargo? Or was it the evolution of new grammar circuits in the human brain that helped us combine words according to precise rules, so as to convey a great variety of different meanings, as the linguist Noam Chomsky has suggested? This is a tempting idea, because as another linguist, Steven Pinker, puts it, the really difficult trick was to design a code that can extrude a tangled spaghetti of concepts into a linear string of words, and to do this so efficiently that the hearer could quickly recreate the spaghetti of concepts from the linear string. Was human language enabled by the increased space for thinking available in the enlarged cortex, which could hold enough complex thoughts in place to form syntactically complex sentences or let an individual memorize the meanings of thousands of words? Or do improved forms of language have their roots in the sociability and willingness to collaborate that is particularly well developed in our own species? Or was there perhaps a synergy between all these drivers? Whatever happened, our species seems to have been the first to cross a linguistic threshold beyond which information can accumulate within communities and across generations. Like a gold strike, collective learning unleashed a bonanza of information about plants and animals, about soils, fire, and chemicals, and about literature, art, religion, and other humans. Though some information was lost every generation, in the long run, human stores of information accumulated, and that growing wealth of knowledge would drive human history by giving humans access to increasing flows of energy and increasing power over their surroundings. Here is how this mechanism is described by a pioneer of the study of memory, the Nobel Prize winner Erik Kandel. Although the size and structure of the human brain have not changed since Homo sapiens first appeared in East Africa, the learning capability of individual human beings and their historical memory have grown over the centuries through shared learning. That is, through the transmission of culture. Cultural revolution, a non-biological mode of adaptation, acts in parallel with biological evolution as the means of transmitting knowledge of the past and adaptive behavior across generations. All human accomplishments, from antiquity to modern times, are products of a shared memory accumulated over centuries. The great world historian W. H. McNeill constructed his classic world history, The Rise of the West, around the same idea. The principal factor promoting historically significant social change is contact with strangers possessing new and unfamiliar skills. Living in the Paleolithic. Human history begins, then, with collective learning. But when did collective learning begin? Even our alien scientists would hardly have noticed the first flickering of collective learning as they circled Earth 200,000 years ago. Some form of collective learning may have been at work even in H. erectus communities, but its consequences were not yet revolutionary. Hints of more rapid technological change begin to appear in the African archaeological record at least 300,000 years ago in the form of increasingly delicate stone tools, many of them hafted. And it is not just Homo sapiens who show this creativity, but also Neanderthals and the hominin species known as Homo heidelbergensis. Perhaps all these species were acquiring improved forms of language that brought them tantalizingly close to threshold 6. Early evidence of ritual or symbolic or artistic activity is particularly significant because it suggests an ability to think symbolically or tell stories about imaginary beings, and that may indicate the arrival of modern forms of language. Perhaps there was room for only one species to cross the threshold to collective learning. There is an evolutionary mechanism known as competitive exclusion that explains why two species can never share exactly the same niche. One will eventually drive out its rival if it can exploit the same niche slightly more effectively. So we can imagine several species gathering near the evolutionary threshold to collective learning. But then one broke through and began to exploit its environment so efficiently that its numbers multiplied and grew fast enough to lock out its rivals. This may help explain why our closest hominin relatives, such as the Neanderthals, have perished, And our closest surviving relatives, the chimps and gorillas, are approaching extinction. Evidence of technological and cultural change from before 100,000 years ago is foggy and difficult to interpret. Our own lineage began to spread within Africa starting at least 200,000 years ago, which may point